Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Tenderfoot by Robert Vaughn, narrated by Al Kessel. 1. Southwest Missouri, April 28, 1865. Captain Jake Dunford, often called Big Jake because of his size, stood with the other officers of McPike's Raiders, having been summoned to a meeting by Colonel Liam McPike. The Yankee payroll will be coming through mid-morning tomorrow. I wonder how much money it'll be carrying, one of the men mused. Whatever it's carrying, it'll be money for the South and not the Yankees, McPike said. The next morning, McPike, Big Jake, and the others were waiting alongside the road. Earlier, two holes had been dug in the road approximately 20 yards apart. A keg of gunpowder was put into each hole, then covered so that, without a close examination, they wouldn't be noticed.
"Colonel, the coaches are coming," one of the men called.
"All right, get ready," McPike ordered.
Narrow channels had been dug in the road, leading from the hidden holes to the side of the road, and those channels had been filled with gunpowder. As Jake waited with the others, he could hear the approach of the coach, not only by the squeak and rumble of the coach itself, but also with the jangle of harness and bit, as well as the drum of hoofbeats. There was a guard riding on the coach, and two more mounted guards, one riding on either side.
"Now,"
McPike called, as the coach passed over the first covered hole. There were two men waiting at the end of each of the narrowed channels, and they set a flame to the line of gunpowder. Smoke and sparks raced across the road, then two loud explosions occurred, one before and one behind the coach. The explosion startled the horses, and the four-horse team pulling the coach came to a halt. One of the men riding alongside the coach was thrown from his horse.
"What the hell?"
the driver shouted.
"You men throw up your hands," McPike called as he and his raiders rose from their concealment on either side of the road.
"Mister, ain't you got the word?"
the shotgun guard called down.
"The war's over."
"We've received no such word," McPike said.
"It's been over for 2 or 3 weeks now. Lee surrendered to General Grant."
"The hell you say? There ain't no way General Lee would surrender to a damn Yankee,"
Ed said.
"It's true, all right. Our colonel got a telegram telling us all about it," the coach driver said.
"Throw down the money," McPike ordered.
"Didn't you hear what I said?
The war's over."
"I don't care.
Throw down the money."
"But now that the war's over, that'd be stealing,"
the driver insisted.
"It's no different from what you've been doing for nearly 5 years, McPike said. "You two climb down."
Still protesting, the driver and guard climbed down from the coach.
"Cosell, go up there and get the money," McPike ordered.
Lieutenant Cosell hurried over to the coach and, using the spokes of the front wheel, climbed up onto the driver's box. Looking down into the splashboard, he saw a canvas bag.
"Here it is, boys,"
he called, holding it out for the others to see.
"Cut the team loose, then set them running. Do the same with the two riders' horses."
With the team cut loose from the coach and the two riders dismounted, McPike's men began shooting into the air, causing the horses to gallop away.
"You boys wearing long johns under your uniforms?" McPike asked.
"Why are you wanting to know?"
"On account of, I wouldn't want you to be plumb naked when you walk into your camp."
"What?"
the driver shouted.
"Shuck out of those uniforms, boys. You're going to take a walk."
McPike's raiders consisted of 8 men, and they laughed at the sight of the 4 Yankee soldiers, walking away wearing nothing but their long john underwear. Cosell opened the canvas bag.
"There's money in here, Colonel, lots of it," he said.
"If the South really has surrendered, what are we going to do with the money?" Jake asked.
"Why, hell, We'll keep it, McPike replied, to the cheers of agreement from the others.
No, Jake said. He shook his head.
I wasn't an outlaw before the war started, and I don't plan to be one now.
Me neither, Ed said.
Before the war, Ed Reynolds had worked as a cook on the ranch owned by Jake's father. He and Jake had been longtime friends, and when Jake went to war, so did Ed.
That's all right with me, McPike said.
That'll just mean more money for the rest of us.
Come on, Ed, Jake said.
If the war really is over, I'm ready to go home.
2 weeks later, Jake stood over the graves of his mother and father. Behind him were the remains of what had once been his home. The house and barn were piles of charred lumber, the corral fence was down, and not one horse, mule, cow, or even chicken remained upon what, before the war, had been a productive 5,000-acre ranch. Jake knew that his parents had been killed by the same Yankee raiders who had burned the ranch. In addition, he learned that the entire ranch had been seized by the Yankee government for taxes.
Those low-life Yankee bastards, Ed said. We wasn't regular soldiers during the war, but at least we never done nothing like this.
The ranch adjacent to the Dunford Ranch was the Triple Crown Ranch, 30,000 acres belonging to Jonas Perkins, who, during the war, had been a general in the Texas 20th Brigade of Tarrant County. Before the war, he had been one of the largest and most successful ranchers in Texas. But now, Perkins was nearly destitute. His house hadn't been burned, but his herds had been decimated. When Big Jake went to see Perkins, calling on him late one evening, he was struck with melancholy over what he saw. The once proud rancher, who had ruled over 30,000 acres of land and 15,000 head of cattle, now sat forlornly in a rocking chair, a broken man. The house was in disrepair, the barns were tumbling down, and the bunkhouses and fields were empty.
General?
Big Jake said, tying his horse to a broken hitch rail in front of the general's house.
General Perkins, it's me, Jake Dunford.
Jake, General Perkins said.
He smiled and stood up.
Jake, how nice of you to come visit me. Come up here. Have a seat, boy. Have a seat.
Jake sat on an empty keg next to Perkins and looked at him. He sighed.
We paid a terrible price, didn't we, General?
Yes,
the General said.
But honor is dear, my boy. It is very dear.
Honor? Is that what it was?
Of course.
Some of us are still paying. Ed and me, for example. There's nothing left of my parents' ranch, and because we rode with McPike's raiders, there are reward posters out on us. We can't even show ourselves in public. I had to sneak out here to see you when I was sure there was no one else around.
Jake, I must know, General Perkins said. The money. Did you keep any of the money you took?
I would have hoped you would know me better than to ask that question, he said.
He thought of McPike and the others, who had kept the last money they had taken. He started to tell the general about McPike, but decided not to.
No, I didn't keep any of the money.
I heard that you lost your ranch to Texas. I also know about what happened to Frank and Agnes. I'm sorry about your parents. They were good people.
Thanks.
I wish I could do something for you. I really do.
He held his hand out, taking in his ranch.
I wish I could put this ranch back the way it was, and your ranch, and the homes and ranches and farms of all the men from the South who gave so much in a losing cause.
but I can't.
It's not right, Jake said. There's nothing about it that's right.
2. Everywhere Jake looked in Fort Worth, he saw Yankee soldiers. There were men wearing blue in all the restaurants, saloons, and out on the street. One thing he noticed was that he never saw a Yankee soldier standing alone. They were always in groups of 3 or 4 or more. At first, he wondered why they were always in groups. Then he realized that it must be for protection. The Yankee soldiers were frightened they might be set upon by some of the men who had fought for the South. Jake was having a beer in the Watering Hole Saloon, which had more Yankee soldiers than locals.
Hey, what do you think about that ranch Briggs has started? One of the Yankee soldiers asked.
Briggs?
You mean Lieutenant Briggs?
I thought he got out of the army, another replied.
Yeah, he did.
And not soon enough, if you ask me, another of the soldiers said.
How the hell that son of a bitch ever made an officer is beyond me. He doesn't have sense enough to pour piss out of a boot.
What do you mean he started a ranch?
Just like I'm saying, he managed to gather up some land that got took for taxes and a bunch of cows, and he started himself a ranch.
Yeah, well, you can bet he didn't come about it honest.
That conversation got Jake to thinking, so he went to Ed with his idea. Then the two of them returned to see General Perkins.
General, how many acres of land do you have left?
I have about 15,000 acres that haven't been taken for taxes, Perkins said. Then he added, but all the land's good for now is to help hold the world together. I don't even have a milk cow left.
What if Ed and I gathered a herd?
Could we run them here on your grass and water until we could sell them?
We could split the profit.
Where would you get a herd?
I've heard of some pretty large carpet bag spreads near here, Jake said. Most of their cattle came from our herds. I'll just take some of them back.
Legally, that's cattle rustling, General Perkins warned.
Jake smiled.
I'd as soon have the game as the name, he said.
3 days later, Jake and Dad had gathered 4 more former soldiers, and the 6 of them called upon the Briggs Ranch. It was just after sunrise, and they rode into a field where there were about 500 cattle.
Look here, Ed said. This is a Circle Y brand. This cow came from the Younger Ranch.
And here's some from the Triple Crown, another said.
Jake, wasn't the DX your folks' brand? Someone asked.
Yes.
Then these here 2 cows is yours.
Wrong, Jake said.
What?
Jake smiled.
Every steer in this field is ours, so let's get them over to the Triple Crown.
The 6 men moved into position, then started moving the cattle away from the Briggs Ranch. By mid-afternoon, all the cattle had been taken to the Triple Crown. By now, there were several new ranches in the area, owned by men who had no previous ranching experience and who weren't even Texans. These were carpetbaggers, Yankees who had come to Texas to take advantage of an abundance of land and cheap cattle. The cattle and land were both available and cheap because they had been confiscated as spoils of war. Big Jake, Ed, and 4 men they had gathered to ride with them began taking cattle from the carpetbaggers' ranches. Within 2 months, there were 3,500 head of cattle of various brands in the fields of the Triple Crown. That many cattle required hands to look after them, so once again, the Triple Crown became a productive ranch, complete with wranglers. The once empty bunkhouses were opened again, and the Triple Crown was well on its way to returning to its pre-war productivity. In addition to recovering confiscated cattle from the carpetbagger ranches, they also began cow hunts, rounding up cattle that had gone astray during the war,
when there weren't enough cowboys to look after them. The carpetbaggers, realizing that their herds were being systematically thinned, complained to the local authorities. But the local sheriffs, deputies, and reconstituted Texas Rangers, realizing that Jake and the others were setting things right by recovering stolen cattle, offered no response to the complaints filed by the carpetbaggers. As a result of the local authorities showing no interest in how Jake and the others were rebuilding their ranches, Yankee carpetbaggers formed a cattlemen's association and established a cattlemen's enforcement agency. The enforcement agency members were appointed as special U.S. deputies, which gave them the authority to investigate what they considered to be cattle thieves. One afternoon, Jake, Ed, and Dave Johnson were driving a string of 15 beeves that had been reacquired from a carpetbagger. What was significant about these cows was that every one of them bore the branding of the Rocking J, which was Abe Johnson's brand. "Looks like we've got some visitors coming our way," Abe said, nodding toward four men who were riding toward them. "Association deputies, do you reckon?" Ed asked. "More than likely," Jake agreed. As the four men approached, Jake saw that all four were holding guns. "Where you boys going with them stoled cows?" one of the deputies asked. "You're right, they are stolen. But they were stolen from me," Abe said. "I'm just taking them back home now. If you look, you'll see that they all have my brand." "That don't matter none. They was legal confiscated," one of the deputies said. "So if you got them, that makes them stoled." "We can take it to court," Jake said. "I think the court will see it our way." "You're right. A Texas court probably would, which is why we'll just hold the court right here." The deputy who spoke pulled the trigger, and Abe was shot out of his saddle.
"What the hell?" Ed shouted.
Jake and Ed drew their own pistols then, and in the exchange of fire, Jake hit his horse shot out from under him. But in that same exchange of fire, all four deputies were killed. Neither Jake nor Ed was hit, but Abe was killed.
"The sons of bitches," Ed said. "Me and Abe had been friends since we was kids."
"I don't think it'll be safe for you two boys to stay here any longer. I think you should go somewhere else,"
Perkins said when they reached the Triple Crown and told him what happened.
"And just where would that be?"
"Arizona," Perkins suggested.
"What?"
"You should go to Arizona. There won't be anyone out there who's ever heard of either one of you."
"What about my cattle? I can't drive them all the way to Arizona," Jake said.
"I'll give you $1,500 for your cattle," Perkins offered. "I know they're worth more than that, but that's all I can afford."
"Well, it's better than just leaving them here," Jake said.
"Eagle Canyon," Perkins suggested.
"What's that?"
"It's a place somewhere in northern Arizona, near the San Francisco Peaks. Once you get there, look for the Turquoise Ranch. You shouldn't have any trouble finding it. Curly says it's the biggest ranch in Arizona."
"Curly?"
"Yeah, Curly Stevens. Remember him?"
"Yes, he used to work for you."
"I'll write a letter for you to give to him."
It took Jake and Ed just under a month to reach Arizona. Once they arrived, they were on the southern margin of the Colorado Plateau, which offered an exceptional variety of geologic wonders. The landscape of the plateau was composed of the towering, glaciated peaks of the San Francisco Mountains, underground lava tubes and blowholes, meteor-blasted Barringer Crater, and cinder cones and lava flows from the San Francisco volcanic field. It was here that they believed they would find Turquoise Ranch. Their horses were travel-worn and tired as Jake and Ed rode on down the trail toward the town that they hoped was just over the next rise, or perhaps beyond the next hill. It was four more hills before a town was encountered, if the place could be called a town. There were only two streets, and they formed an X with the bulk of the buildings near the crossroad. The buildings were low and rough wood, though several of them had wooden fronts which rose higher than the buildings themselves. A raised wooden sidewalk graced both sides of the street for the length of the nicer of the buildings, but after a short distance, the sidewalk ended, and there was nothing but a small dirt path in front of the shabbier buildings. The biggest and most prominent structure was a saloon, identified by the sign painted on front as the Gilded Cage.
"Well, I reckon that's as good a place as any for a fella to get a plate full of beans and something to cut this dust," Ed suggested.
Jake agreed, and the two men tied their horses off in front of the building and went inside. There were more than a dozen men inside, and they looked up with unbridled curiosity as Jake and Ed entered. In a town this remote, no stranger went unnoticed. The bartender came over and passed a damp rag across the bar in front of them.
"What'll it be?" he asked.
That was the only question voiced, but his eyes asked volumes.
"Whiskey and a little grub if you serve victuals here," Jake said.
"Beans," the bartender said. "With a hot pepper for seasoning."
"Sounds mighty fine," Jake agreed.
There was a sudden fanfare of guitar music, and Jake and Ed turned to see a Mexican man sitting on a stool, holding a guitar. A moment later, a very pretty young woman came out and began a flamenco dance to the young man's accompaniment.
"Well, now," Ed said, smiling, "I'd say this is a right friendly little town to set up a welcome like this for us."
The girl proved to be even more friendly, for after her dance, she answered Ed's smile and came to sit with the two men. Her name was Angelina, and she was the sister of the guitar player. Ed bought her a drink while Jake obligingly offered to take care of the horses. It was then that Jake saw Maggie for the first time. It was also nearly the last time, for Maggie and an older man who was with her were standing near the wall of the livery stable with their hands raised. Two masked men were holding drawn guns on them, and one of the gunmen was relieving Maggie's companion of his wallet.
"Heh,"
the gunman who had just taken the wallet said.
"What'd I tell you? He just sold 500 head of cattle. I knowed he'd be carrying a fat wallet."
"That's not my money," the robbery victim said. "That belongs to Mr. Edward Baker and the brand."
"Wrong," the robber said with a laugh. "It belongs to us now."
"I know who you two men are," Maggie said. "You're Froggy Dolan, and you're Augie Phillips. Papa, you remember, they're the two who ran off last year. They stole a couple of horses, too, if I recall."
"Augie, what the hell?"
one of the gunmen said, and it was clear by the expression in his voice that her recognition had disturbed him.
"She knows who we are."
"Shut up, you damn fool," Augie replied.
His voice, like that of his companion, was muffled by the hood he wore over his head. "I see you aren't much better at robbing than you were at punching cattle," the girl's father said.
"You know the trouble with you two. You got too good a memory and too big a mouth. We're gonna have to kill the both of you."
"No, I don't think you will," Jake called.
He had waited until now to make his presence known, just to make certain that things were what they seemed to be.
"Augie, shoot him!"
Froggy yelled, and both robbers turned toward Jake with their guns blazing. But Jake had already pulled his gun before he challenged them, and he stood there as the two men shot wildly, returning their fire with deadly accuracy. Both men fell to his bullets.
"Are you two all right?"
Jake asked, holstering his pistol after the two men were down.
"Yes, thanks to you," the older man said.
He smiled and extended his hand.
"My name is Abel Cole, mister. This here is my daughter, Maggie. I don't know that I've ever seen better shooting."
The name is Jake Dunford, and I got lucky, that's all, Jake said.
No, sir. We're the ones who got lucky when you came along. Tell me, Mr. Dunford, is there anything I can do for you? I'm sure Mr. Baker would like to reward you for what you did here.
Mr. Baker?
Clyde Baker. He's the manager of the Turquoise Ranch. I'm his foreman.
Jake smiled. Well, now, this is a lucky break. My partner and I came here looking to get a job with the Turquoise Ranch. Do you know Curly Stevens?
Yes, of course I know Curly. He's a good hand.
We have a letter to Curly from a mutual friend. We were going to ask Curly to get us on with the ranch.
You know anything about cattle?
Jake smiled. We're from Texas.
Abel Cole laughed. I reckon that's recommendation enough for me. Where is your pard now?
He's tied up for the moment, Jake said, smiling and looking at Maggie really closely for the first time.
What a beautiful girl she was.
Miss, you wouldn't be married or anything, would you?
He asked, tipping his hat politely to her.
Married? Maggie replied. She smiled.
No, Mr. Dunford, I'm not married.
Engaged or spoken for?
Maggie laughed.
No, I'm not spoken for either. I'm my own woman, Mr. Dunford.
That's good, Jake said. That's real good.
Jake decided then and there that this was the woman he was going to marry.
3. 20 years later. Jake stood looking down at the graves of Maggie and her father. Maggie had died of meningitis 9 years earlier, leaving Jake with a 10-year-old daughter, Melanie. Cole had died a year before Maggie, at which time Theodore Baker had appointed Jake as foreman of the Turquoise Ranch. When Theodore retired, he attempted to get Jake appointed to take his place as ranch manager, but was unable to do so.
Morgan, Trevathan, and I want a lawyer, Theodore said. I'm sorry. I tried to get them to hire you as the manager. I would have gone directly to the owner, if I had any idea who the owner was. It's hard to believe that, after all these years, nobody actually knows who owns the turquoise, Jake had said. I'm not sure anyone owns it, Theodore said. I mean, any one person. Morgan, Trevathan, and Dye is a legal firm, which is why they use a manager. I don't know why they've decided now that they want a lawyer as manager. Hell, I'm not a lawyer, and I've managed the ranch for more than 20 years.
Thus it was that, for the last year, Les Garrison, a lawyer from Denver, had been manager of Turquoise Ranch and the 15,000 head of cattle encompassed on the 30,000 acres of well-watered grassland that made up the ranch.
I thought I might find you out here with Mama and Grandpa.
Jake turned to see his daughter Melanie, now a beautiful 20-year-old young woman.
Hello, darling. What did you need? Jake asked.
Les wants to see you.
He's not in my office, is he?
Melanie smiled.
No, Papa. I know better than that. He's waiting in the parlor.
Jake and Melanie lived in the foreman's house, which was a nice house with a parlor, dining room, kitchen, a small office, and 2 bedrooms. The biggest house on the ranch would be where the owner would live, if there had been an owner in residence. Jake and the 15 men who worked on the turquoise called it the big house. And because there was no resident owner, that house was currently occupied by Les Garrison, the ranch manager. Les Garrison was a handsome man and quite vain about it. Whereas everyone else on the ranch wore denims and linsey-woolsey shirts, Garrison often wore a suit, a white shirt, and a silver and turquoise bolo tie.
What can I do for you, Les? Jake asked.
Is it true that you fired Woods and Peavy? Garrison asked.
Yes.
Why?
They aren't holding up.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?